Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, everybody. I'm David Green. Well, Biden, Trump, like it or not, and many of you don't, according to polls, it's becoming more and more likely that this will be the presidential race this fall. Trump won New Hampshire. Biden won New Hampshire, sort of. They're all kind of asterisks there since the Democratic Party wasn't officially recognizing New Hampshire's obsession with going first, and Biden wasn't on the ballot but won as a write-in. But all of that really won't matter nearly as much as, you know, the vision that these two men have for our country. What do they want? What is their argument to us, the voters, for why we would want to support either Donald Trump or Joe Biden? Well, that's what we're going to spend a lot of time on today. And I'm lucky to be in Washington, D.C. for such a conversation, in a studio, in person, with two of my favorite D.C. residents, Mo Alathy and Sarah Isger. Hello to you both.
Hello.
It's fun to be together in person. Mo, you I mean, you used to literally be in charge of communication for the Democratic Party. So what – I mean, in a minute or two, like what's the pitch from Joe Biden for why voters should give him 4 more years?
Well, to be clear, I don't think any one person's ever in charge of messaging for the Democratic Party.
It's purportedly your job at DNC, but yeah.
Look, I think Joe Biden is going to run a – traditional incumbent message on one hand and a very different one on the other. He's going to talk about his accomplishments over the first 3 years of his presidency. He's going to talk about the trajectory of the economy, which has shown record growth and record job growth and slowing the rate of inflation, and he could go on and on. He's going to talk about that because that's what incumbents do, and in part because he has to, because people right now don't believe those things. He can't just see that. He's got to go out there. So he will talk about the progress made over the first 3 years of his presidency, and he's going to draw a very strong contrast with Donald Trump, and that's where it's going to be non-traditional, because the fundamental argument he's going to make about Donald Trump is that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy, which is, while Sarah will likely disagree, it is not a typical traditional message that you articulate. So it's going to be sharper in some ways. And I think what he's going to do is talk about, look how far we've come. Here's what's next. And he's going to talk about that. There are already reports that they're talking about certain parts of an economic agenda that they want to roll out in the coming weeks and months for what the next 4 years would look like. None of this can happen. None of this progress would have happened. None of this progress can continue to happen if our democracy remains under threat. He's going to talk about how here's what we are focused on as Democrats versus the other side, which is attacking your fundamental freedoms. And proof point number one will be abortion, will be women's ability to make their own health choices.
And making it harder to get an abortion. I mean, you were kind of on this months and months ago, the idea that that is a threat to freedom, that that freedom argument is very central to the Democratic argument, because the protect your freedoms argument is often something we hear so much more from Republicans. But around abortion, Democrats are trying to own that.
Right. For reasons unknown to me, Democrats have for too long just ceded that value of freedom to Republicans. You are seeing them now try to turn it on its head. Pete Buttigieg started to do that in the last election. You see the president, the vice president, doing it very, very aggressively now, trying to turn that around and say, we're not the ones taking away your freedoms. We're not the ones trying to restrict your access to abortion. We're not the ones telling your kids what books they can and can't read in their school libraries. And while they are focused on that, we're going to be focused on this.
But you're saying stay tuned. We're going to see more of
it. But I think you're
going to
see a lot more of it. You already started just this week. The president accepted the endorsement of the United Auto Workers Union. Not a big surprise, right? But what he talked about in the speech where he accepted that endorsement was a very populist economic message. And I think you're going to see them leaning into that more and more.
Sarah, where would you agree, disagree when it comes to how you see Biden's pitch to Americans?
Yeah, so I think this is going to be super asymmetrical because Biden is going to run a very traditional campaign. And look, all those messages are going to be tailored for 2024. I get that. But that in the main, they will be packaged like a traditional political campaign from an incumbent president to the Democratic Party and independent, you know, leaning Democrats, you know, all of that. It will be incredibly sort of traditional in that way. But it's like, I don't even know what the best analogy is. There's this like swirling storm outside and like Joe Biden's like cozy next to the fire. And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You're like missing the whole storm outside. The parties are realigning incredibly quickly. Donald Trump's not going to run a traditional campaign for Republicans and right-leaning independents because he's basically ditched the former definition of what a Republican is, and he's trying to form a new coalition of voters. It's why you're seeing the Republican Party become more racially diverse, you know, appeal to non-college educated voters at a much higher degree. More men are voting Republican. And at the same time, the Democratic Party is getting wealthier, more college educated, less racially diverse, interestingly enough. Feels like Joe Biden's team is kind of sticking their fingers in their ears and saying, la, 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 we're still talking to the Democratic Party from 10 years ago. And that coalition doesn't, it exists. I don't want to say it doesn't, but it's fracturing pretty quickly. And if Donald Trump can, you know, put some ice picks in some key spots, it will look pretty dumb to have run a traditional incumbent's campaign. And then you add in, again, like, it's not that I think issues are going to be particularly important in 2024.
Although they're nice. It's good to talk about issues sometimes. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I guess what I mean, though, is when both sides are going to be talking about issues, the issues are going to be the way that they're hitting a cultural nerve. As in that it's not the issue or a solution to an American problem that they're really trying to pitch to the American people. Here's my 10-point plan to save Social Security. Well, compare that to the other guy's 10-point plan, and I think one of these will be more effective than the other. Like, that's not what issues are going to come around.
If policy plans determined who won, President Hillary Clinton or President Mitt Romney would be running for re-election.
So true.
Well, but let's listen to a little bit of President Biden, because I'd love to focus a little bit on like policy and solutions, even though, I mean, your cultural nerve phrase, I mean, that's so interesting, because I do feel like even when candidates these days are bringing up like solutions, it's like, how is that making me feel? How am I reacting to that? Which is important in an election, too. But so Biden recently spoke about his vision at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. He remembered how 9 people were killed there in a horrific mass shooting in 2015. Also spoke about the economy. So let's listen.
I said we'd invest in all of America, all America, and we are. The results are clear. Over 14 million new jobs, record economic growth, the lowest inflation rate of any major economy in the world. But we got more to do. We see this progress for all Americans. We have the lowest black unemployment rate recorded in a long, long time. More black Americans have health insurance than ever, bringing peace of mind and dignity to their lives.
So I know we're minimizing how much policies might matter to voters in this year. But like, as you listen to that, Mo, what is an idea? What is a proposal? What is something that Biden can point to and say, this is part of my economic policy that has worked for the country, and this is part of my economic agenda for a second term?
And we've talked about this before. Policy proposals are the proof point. They are not what moves people. Sarah's 100% right. People are moved for emotional reasons, right? That cultural nerve, a sense of either hope and optimism or existential dread.
But also, do I have a job or do I don't? I mean, that's a real thing. Right? That's not just a feeling.
But it all builds into something else, right? When people lose their jobs, it's because they feel like cultural forces are at play that are giving their jobs to someone else, right? You hear people who bemoan in the manufacturing industry the fact that they're losing jobs to immigrants. They're not losing jobs to immigrants. They're losing jobs to robots. But political figures come in and touch that cultural nerve, that sense of dread, that sense of fear, and turn it into a political issue. So I'm not saying And I don't think Sarah, not to put words in her mouth, but I doubt Sarah's saying this either, that policy doesn't matter, but they are the proof points to something else. Hmm. And so what is that something else that he's trying to communicate here?
Yeah.
That we are moving in the right direction. I came in and inherited a terrible situation. We are moving in the right direction. Not enough people are feeling it. So we're going to keep trying to move in that direction. But there's no way we can if this other guy comes in threatening how our government works, threatening our democracy, taking away your individual freedoms. You can't worry about your economic well-being if you're worried about your physical safety, which is why we need to get guns off the streets, right? This is how you turn those emotional feelings, those cultural nerves, into a policy conversation. But there aren't going to be a lot of people that sit there, as Sarah pointed out, which 10-point plan on Social Security? What should the effective tax rate be? That's not what people vote on. They vote on, do I trust that you get the situation I am in, and will the other person make it better or worse?
I mean, how fascinating to use that clip, right? Because it's almost my perfect example of running a very traditional, even the cadence in which he is talking. If I played that to, in fact, I did this recently to someone who was visiting the country. And they were like, is that a politician? I was like, yep, good guess. Right? Like, there's a cadence involved. There's a way they look.
Yeah.
This is not the right time for that.
To sound like a politician from the 80s.
Yeah, to start quoting statistics and numbers and all of that. You notice Donald Trump basically never does that. He just states something as fact that may or may not be fact.
Might be untrue.
Right. But there's no like, well, there's been a 14.7% rise. And no, like there's none of that.
Well, let me compare that Biden that we just heard to a different Biden and see if you hear something different. Because this is Biden in the same speech, but talking about what happened in this church in Charleston in 2015 and kind of extrapolating from there.
On June 17, 2015, the beautiful souls, five survivors, invited a stranger into this church to pray with them. The word of God was pierced by bullets and hate, of rage, propelled by not just gunpowder, but by a poison. Poison that has for too long haunted this nation. And what is that poison? White supremacy. Oh, it is. It's a poison throughout our history.
So the thing that got me in this speech was, you know, we've talked, the three of us together, about Biden's message that, like, the MAGA movement is going to destroy democracy. It's terrifying. In this speech, he brought together the poison of white supremacy. He brought up January 6th. He brought up political violence. He brought up the idea of truth and said that truth means, for example, understanding – you know, slavery as such a fundamental, horrific ill in American society and something that we have to confront. And the truth is important. Somehow to me, this was not just saying this MAGA movement is terrible. It was really casting so much of what his fears are for our country in language that to me that sounds like a political speech. I will give you that in a lot of ways. But it's not a 10-point plan.
That's true. And so a few things. One, it's clearly a written speech. That's not how normal people talk.
Fair.
For too long, we have like, no one actually says that, I think, in real life. And Donald Trump doesn't really talk off written speeches very often. So again, you have this asymmetry going on between the two campaigns, which I think will be my overall theme here. Also, though, and this gets to some of the polling that we've talked about previously, the Biden plan to run against Donald Trump because he is a unique threat to democracy is deeply undermined when you ask the American people what they're anxious about. They are anxious about threats to democracy, but they're about split on who the threats are. They're anxious about the economy. And to your point, you know, you're talking about someone like losing their job. Yes, but that's actually a relatively small portion of the American people at any given point that actually have lost their job. For the vast majority of voters that we're talking about, it's anxiety about whether they will lose their job.
Yeah.
And that's what's keeping them up at night. If I lose my job, how will I pay my mortgage? Where will my health insurance go?
Has my back? Then it becomes a real
feeling.
Who
has my back? Like, who's going to take my job? All of those things are anxiety filling. It may never happen, but they're still going to vote on that anxiety. And I guess that's my point about why the 10-point plans don't work.
Yeah, but look, you know, and this is what a campaign's about, right? They're also talking to different people.
absolutely true.
Right? And,
yes.
And that matters in this race. You know, for a lot of people out there, they don't want, they see that that asymmetry as well. They don't want that Donald Trump cadence. They don't want to hear the way he speaks and how hyperbolic, if I'm being generous, or dishonest, if I'm being accurate, you know, he is when he speaks. They don't like, you know, they want someone who, whatever the cadence is, speaks to some of their concerns. And I think for a huge portion of the country, Joe Biden does that better than Donald Trump. That's who he needs.
It doesn't even look like a huge portion of the Democratic Party, though, thinks that.
I couldn't disagree with you more because, again, in an election, it is a choice.
Yeah.
And he may not have been their first choice for who carries the flag, but they are fine with him carrying the flag, especially against the person carrying the other flag. Look, I've always believed that there are three important questions that people ask themselves when they walk into a voting booth. One, does this person get me? Just fundamentally, do they understand me and what I'm going through? Number two, can they just do the job? Basic sense of competence. And then third, which of these people would I invite into my home for dinner? Not which of these people would I go, what would I want to have a beer with, right? The famous political beer test.
Right.
There's a lot of people I would go have a beer with.
But you're not letting them into your
house. I'm not letting them sit at my dinner table with my wife and kids, right?
But those are the marks that
Biden needs
to
hit. Those, I
think,
are the marks that most people think about, right? Do they get me? Can they do the job? And do I trust them? Because that's what you're doing when you let someone into your home. It's trust. I think this is an election where people don't feel good about either candidate. Biden is trying to get them to feel a little bit better. When he's talking about the economy and he's going through statistics, Sarah, you're right. Like, everyone's eyes glaze over. But when he's talking about the economy and he tells that story that we have heard a million times, but most Americans haven't, about his dad coming into his bedroom after getting laid off and saying, "Honey, Joey, we're going to be okay," right? But he could see the anxiety in his face. People hear him say that, and they know he gets them. And that's what he's got to do more of, connecting this economic populism with people's real lives and drawing the contrast about how it's all being threatened by the other side.
All right, we're going to have to take a break. We'll come back in just a few minutes to talk about Donald Trump and his pitch to voters and his vision for the United States of America. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple. Okay, we're back again with more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Moa Lathy, the executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service, is here to my right, which feels weird because that's supposed to be the opposite. Sarah Isger is on my left, which also feels weird, but she's senior editor at The Dispatch and former spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump, who we are about to talk about in some depth right now. We talked about Joe Biden's vision for our country, his argument to voters. What is Donald Trump's larger message? Well, let's listen to a little bit.
And as soon as I lift my hand from that beautiful Bible that we're going to use, a specific Bible, a very beautiful Bible, as your 47th president, and we're all in this together, you've been great from day one. You were so great in 2016. You were so great to me. Remember, we won by 21 points. We came in. They said, "Who the hell is that guy?" And we won by 21 points. But I'll seal the border and we'll shut down the invasion of our country, number one. That's the first thing. And we will almost simultaneously, I would say, let that have one day, right, Al? One day. But we will unleash American energy like I unleashed it before, except this time we're going to keep it going because they turned it off. We will terminate every diversity, equity, and inclusion program across the entire federal government. And I will instruct the heads of ICE and Border Patrol to begin the largest deportation program in American history. We have no choice.
You know, it's interesting hearing Donald Trump talk about the border and immigration, because we have seen how the command he has over his party right now on that issue. I mean, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, basically we've seen reports acknowledge that a very precarious deal to give more aid to Ukraine and also get a lot of what Republicans want in terms of border security, it might be a non-starter now, because McConnell's basically saying Donald Trump doesn't want that deal. He thinks that it should go a lot further when it comes to border security, and that's going to undermine chances to have that deal. So I guess that's the question I want to start with. Like, if Donald Trump is saying the deal in the Senate is not enough, we need even stricter border enforcement, we need to tighten the borders even more, what is he talking about, and what would that policy be, and what's the pitch he's making here?
Oh, see, I read that far more cynically than you did. I hope you're right, that it's simply that they want more than they're getting in this deal and want to wait. I actually read McConnell's statement to be that Donald Trump wants to run on immigration and doesn't want the problem to be solved before the election.
Well, you think it was naked politics? Yes. Like, let's just keep this issue going. If we make a deal, then Donald Trump loses this issue.
Don't give Biden the win.
Now, and let me be clear. Barack Obama came into office with both houses of Congress and the White House. He didn't tackle immigration. Donald Trump came into the White House with both houses of Congress and the White House. He didn't tackle immigration. Both sides have wanted to run on this issue more than they've wanted to solve it. But as was always going to be the case, and will almost always be the case with America's largest problems, at some point the teapot will bubble over. And we're at the bubbling over point where both sides now agree that this is a true crisis. It's a crisis for the people here. It's a crisis for the people trying to come. It's dangerous. We're funding cartels, which is insane to me. And the White House alone, at this point, I think, has acknowledged there's nothing they can do, that they have to have solutions from Congress. The Supreme Court has said so as well. Look, to go back to something Mo said, his three things that voters think about when they walk in.
Yeah.
If those are the three things that Americans think about when they walk in the voting booth in November 2024, Joe Biden will win in a landslide. But I'm willing to bet it won't be those three things. Because to understand Donald Trump's appeal, you have to understand that's not what they're thinking about. A lot of people voting for Donald Trump would never want him in their house, don't want him around their children. Some do. And they also don't necessarily think he gets people like them. They assume he's never met anyone like them.
And what was the third one? Trust? Do they trust
competence,
him?
And I'm not sure most people believe either guy is very competent right now.
Oh, that's fair enough. Donald Trump taps into something. Again, this is part of the asymmetry. I'm going to try to give maybe a more extreme example than I mean, just to serve the point. Joe Biden's more traditional appealing to the coalition that is going to, you know, win him the election is all about sort of seeing where people are and tapping those different groups and trying to get them, you know, trying to build a coalition that can get to 51%. Donald Trump has done something very different. Now, it's important to remember, he didn't win the popular vote in 2016, and he sure as hell didn't win it in 2020. So I'm talking about this in the needle-threadingest of ways.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't see where people are politically and then try to build that into a 51% coalition. Instead, he's out there on vibes, with the policy as part of the vibes, to your point, David, and he waits for people to come to him. And it's been incredibly successful, all things considered, in that other way that we've done politics for 50 years, let's say, you know, the polling and the focus groups and all that stuff, that he is able to build something else without really doing any of that.
I think Sarah's absolutely right on this. Though I do stand by my three questions, right? Because I think a lot of Donald Trump's voters actually would say in the affirmative that he checks those boxes. They would say, yeah, the guy doesn't live like me. He doesn't come from me, but he gets me. And he's saying the things that no one else will say that I'm worried about, that I'm freaked out about, right? So he's out there saying it. And Sarah's right. People are coming to him because they didn't feel like his supporters didn't feel like they had enough of an outlet.
They believe something like immigrants are taking my jobs, and Trump is going to go out there and
I think the core of Donald Trump's message, this was true in 2016, and I think this is true now. The core of his message is they are coming after us. They are coming after you, and I'm the last line of defense.
Who's they?
However the listener wants to interpret it.
They can be anyone. I mean—
Right?
It's the people opposed to us. And he's right that they are coming after you and I'm standing in between is how those indictments not only don't make Donald Trump lose support, it makes his support increase. Mm-hmm. They want to come after you. They know that I'm going to try to protect you, so they're coming after me first. And that's why the Bragg indictment, I think, was so helpful to Donald Trump. Because it actually does look like that, right?
Which indictment are we talking about?
This is the New York indictment over the campaign finance stuff, and I'm going to put that kind of in quotes because it's the state charge that requires a federal charge that the previous prosecutor had passed on. And
it was weak enough that Trump could legitimately say, like, see, they're coming after me.
Truly. I mean, it's eight-year-old stuff. It's a mess. And it really, I think, drove home the point that Donald Trump was making. See, they want open borders so badly, they're willing to trump up these charges to try to prevent you from voting for me. And it's not going to work, is it?
Right.
And let me just correct one thing you said about immigrants trying to take jobs, because I think that was a message 20 years ago that is no longer the message right now. And it's no longer even where the anxiety is. It's not about immigrants taking jobs. It's about people coming into the country who didn't wait their turn, and they're going to fundamentally change what it is to be American. And what they grew up with, what they're trying to teach their children, why they can't take their kids to, the hospital anymore because the hospitals are all filled up in the emergency rooms with people who just came here and are using our social safety net. The schools are falling apart because there's all of these new kids coming in whose parents brought them here illegally that are filling up the school so that your kid, can't even get in to see the teacher after school, et cetera. It's everything that Eric Adams has been saying in New York. The social safety net is falling apart because you can't do both, right? You can't say anyone who wants to come to America should be able to come, but also anyone who is struggling in America, we will support with basic needs, housing, medical care and education. You can't do both at the same time.
And I think this point is so important because it goes back, and I think we may have talked about this in a previous show. Gallup recently had a poll that showed 70%+ of Americans believe that democracy isn't working for them. That means an overwhelming number of Democrats, an overwhelming number of Republicans, and an overwhelming number of independents do not believe democracy is working for them, but for very different reasons. And the case that Sarah just laid out is why so many Trump supporters believe democracy isn't working for them. They're looking at it very differently than how the people that Joe Biden is speaking to would interpret that point. And so it goes back to who are they appealing to? Who are they talking to? Yes, Joe Biden is actually trying to build a coalition. You might call it traditional. I think he's trying a few different things as well. But he's trying to build a coalition. Donald Trump isn't, and he's not bashful about saying that. Donald Trump is not trying to reach out to anyone who's not with him. He just said it again this week. If you're still supporting Nikki Haley, you're out of MAGA world. Get the hell out. I don't want you. He specifically said that. I don't want you. And that's where I think this race is going to get super interesting and where he may be miscalculating. Because at the end of the day, a lot of those people who are not – first of all, there are fewer registered Republicans today than there were 4 years ago or 8 years ago. So relying on that base is shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
But there are those people in the middle, those suburban moms, those folks in the 4 or 5 counties that we can all rattle off that will determine this election in Arizona and Georgia and in Michigan and in Wisconsin. Those people don't necessarily see the world in that view. And so which candidate's argument about the threat to their existence is going to resonate more.
But that's where and I want to go back to one thing that Donald Trump said that we're listening to. He's going to terminate every diversity, equity, inclusion program across the federal government. Like, there's a way that you, if you hate Donald Trump, can say he's racist and doesn't care about policies that support people who were underrepresented. But like, when I hear that, I think back to like the Reagan Democrat days where there were public housing programs and you had families like in working class suburbs in Baltimore and Pittsburgh and other places who had spent like their life working in jobs to make enough money to buy a home, small maybe, but like enough to like raise a family and be a good parent. And when they would watch, you know, some Section 8 public housing policies that in their mind would hand another family something that they had spent a lifetime fighting for. You know, was there racism sometimes? Sure, maybe. But like sometimes it was just this feeling of, you know, why are other people getting things that I have fought to have for my entire life? And I feel like we're in a different day. We're in a less traditional political moment in our country. But some of those fundamental things when it comes to Trump's appeal and when he says things like that, they're still there. And they're not new.
Two things about that. One, fascinating poll recently that looked at Black Americans, asking them what they thought about the Supreme Court's affirmative action decision from last year, but divided by age. And basically older Black Americans disapproved. They wanted the continuation of affirmative action in higher education. Younger Black Americans approved. They no longer think that affirmative action actually is benefiting them. They think it hurts them oftentimes. And it's so interesting you brought up the housing situation because you see something similar happening even in that. You know, a Black family who puts all of their equity into a home is trying to build that generational wealth that frankly was robbed from them through, you know, the Jim Crow South and lots of legacy redlining and stuff in housing. And then you don't actually enforce criminal laws. So carjacking in the District of Columbia, what, by January 6th, I think there had been 50 carjackings. I mean, it was just something crazy. Well, guess whose property value gets sunk? And there's nothing they can do because they no longer can sell their house and then buy a new one. And all of this sweat equity that they had put into that home, you know, a retired couple in D.C., it's gone. And all under this DEI version of, you know, defund the police. And it's not fair to put, you know, these minors in jail for stealing cars. What starts again, and we'll get to some of this, I think, in our next conversation. What starts as a compassionate idea from the left turns into not compassionate for everyone else it affects.
You bring up the generational differences. It is remarkable to me how different this country may look when Gen Z holds all the levers of power against the backdrop of how this campaign is shaping up. We've talked about how young Democrats are in a different place than their parents and grandparents on Israel, Gaza. We've also talked about how young Republicans are in a different place from their parents and grandparents on climate. So in all these different ways, young people are really thinking about these issues and this country and core American values in a very different way than either of these candidates are really talking about it.
I just want to, but before we break, like it's the one point that we made at the top, that Trump can say they are coming to get you and never even have to define what they means, which means, I mean, if you're racist, that speaks to you. If you're anti-immigrant, that speaks to you. If you feel like, you know, you disagree on policies and someone is coming to take your rights away, your gun, I mean, you could define that in myriad different ways. It's kind of brilliant.
And don't forget, they also often means those on the right who are from
the former establishment.
Yeah, the former right. Republican right. So the Mitt Romneys, the Nikki Haleys. So you're right. It's brilliant in a way, but you're pointing out sort of the darkest of dark versions. But it works in a far more just normal
That's
political
right.
context where Donald Trump first has to remake the Republican Party. And that's what I mean, that instead of sort of forming a coalition and then saying the things to meet that coalition's needs, he's out there saying his own thing and hoping the coalition comes to him.
All right, we'll take a break. Sarah and Mo and I will be back in just a few minutes. We're going to talk about homelessness and the meaning of cruel and unusual punishment. All right, we're back for more Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Greene with Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy here in Washington, D.C. So the Department of Housing and Urban Development is reporting that the number of people experiencing homelessness in January of 2023, which was about a year ago, of course, with 650,000 people. And a third of them were living in three Western states, California, Washington, and Oregon. How to address this struggling population has perplexed state and local officials in cities and communities around the country. Now, a solution provided by one city, Grants Pass, Oregon, to address some of the symptoms of their growing homelessness problem is currently being debated by the Supreme Court. And that is our focus here on Left, Right, and Center, Oregon, because this is the latest in our 50 states project. We're considering stories in all 50 states this election year to see what we can learn from the ground up. And if you are on the ground watching news in your community, like in Grants Pass, Oregon, you might hear a story like this from NBC5.
Hopkins is originally from California. He moved in with his daughter last August, but was told to leave because the building did not allow extra tenants. He and his dog has been staying in his tent ever since.
I lost my right eye. My left eye was going. And so I wasn't able to work.
Hopkins now works overnight at a local convenience store. He says he's getting caught up financially, but his current living situation continues to be a setback.
Because you have the police coming every week, moving you out from one park to a park. It's not fair.
So as a profile of someone who is unhoused, William Hopkins, a man living on the streets in Grants Pass. The debate in Grants Pass has now reached the Supreme Court, which is considering whether criminally punishing people who are unhoused using laws like, you know, public camping bans violates the language in the U.S. Constitution that says that laws cannot bring cruel and unusual punishment to people. And Sarah, you brought up this case not because you want to dive into the law, which you often do, which we really appreciate. But because you think it says something interesting about our political dynamic.
Yeah, look, the legal questions are interesting, and feel free to check out Advisory Opinions, my legal podcast, for a deeper dive on that if you really want. But to me, this is a much more interesting question about how you deal with a homelessness crisis in the United States and what is compassion. Because there's an argument, I think, from homelessness advocates that compassion is not moving people who are trying to sleep and allowing them to use public parks because they don't have a home. But there's really an argument on the other side that that's not compassionate, that in fact those are incredibly dangerous places, that allowing people to overdose to death slowly is not the compassionate thing to do. And instead, we should be pushing people into shelters and pushing them into rehabilitation and not allowing communities to fail because they're overtaken by homelessness encampments that then law enforcement can't do anything about. So it's not just a lack of compassion to the people who are then in these, you know, violent, horrible homeless encampments that are prone to arson, fires, you know, assault, rape, et cetera, much higher than any other American community that we have. But also those communities themselves, you know, we just talked about home prices. Well, what happens when you put all of your equity into a home and then a homelessness encampment pops up and they can't move it? Well, no one's going to buy your home now. And so all of your family's equity is gone. So is that compassionate then? And so we're really having a debate where both sides are trying to argue about compassion. And I find that really interesting because it's coming up again and again. It's coming up in the immigration context and it's coming up in this context. And nobody wants to characterize it in that way. And I don't understand why.
Well, it's interesting that you describe that because you think about someone like Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, who is seen as so left. Like, I think a lot of people would come into this thinking like, oh, he's going to say that people should be allowed to live on the streets. You shouldn't have the police going after them and criminally charging them. He's on the side of making sure the community is like Grants Pass and everywhere actually have the ability to have laws.
Correct.
That can go and say, like, you're not allowed to live here with, I presume what you're saying is the goal of, like, let's get them off the streets and let's get them into rehab facilities and get them help.
Especially where there are shelter spots available.
Which
that's
there are
part
not
of the legal argument is that the court originally held, the Ninth Circuit held, that unless there's shelter spots for every homeless person, then you can't move any homeless person, even if there is a spot for that person. So if you have 17,000 available beds, you can't move a single person if there's 20,000 total homeless people, which is kind of a mind-boggling theory, right? And so what Gavin Newsom and others are arguing is, no. If there's a bed available, you can move that person. You can force that person to move to a bed. The problem with a lot of these non-governmental shelters, for instance, religious-based shelters, is that they don't allow you to bring drugs or alcohol. Also, they might not allow you to bring your pet. They might, you know, there's all these rules and restrictions on some of these shelters. And so, again, it comes down to compassion.
You know, and to your point, I feel like something we almost never hear in our political debates, whether it's in our dining rooms or like in the halls of a state capitol house. I disagree with you, but I know that you're trying to do the right thing here. I know that you're trying to solve a problem in a humane way. I mean, that level of empathy in political debates just is almost non-existent.
Think about the abortion conversation. That's one about compassion, too, and who you have more compassion for.
Well, I mean, on an issue like that, I would argue there are a lot of people in the middle who actually would be willing to have conversations where it's trying to understand one another and their views are not reflected in the larger political conversation.
I think our politics just doesn't allow for conflicting emotion sometimes, right?
No.
I mean, I drive down the street and I see homeless encampments or I see tents set up under an overpass and I get outraged and I say, why do we allow people why do we allow people to have to sleep on the street? Why don't we give them a place? Why can't we solve – right? I feel so much compassion and want to get them off the street as quickly as possible. I also see images of police and public safety officials moving people out of camps forcibly. And I feel the same outrage and the same compassion, right? Saying, why can't they just let them be if they have nowhere else to go? Those are two very legitimate feelings to have. Our politics right now doesn't allow for that, doesn't allow us to realize that we can have multiple emotions around an issue, that we can have compassion, that people making different arguments can have compassion, and that these are, frankly, complex issues where there is no one-size-fit-all approach.
Right.
Right? And the homeless and immigration are two great examples of that. The homelessness problem is caused by what? Lack of affordable housing, but also a problem with substance abuse, oftentimes a mental health problem, oftentimes domestic violence. Right? There are so many different factors. Whether or not we allow encampments in a public park isn't the only question we need to resolve here. But now our political conversation, whenever people are talking about Oregon, that's it. That's the conversation. Whereas going to the root of it is so critical in addressing each of those different variables. Same is true about immigration. Do we put up a border wall? What do we do about asylum? Whereas we also should be looking at what are the root causes in the home countries. Is there anything we can do on at an international level to stop people from feeling like they have to flee from their home country? All of these are important parts of the conversation. The gun control debate, there's a bright line.
Absolutely. It has to be binary. It's either about the gun or it's about mental health.
Right.
And it can't be
both. And it is 100%, in my opinion, about both.
Of course it is.
And so I don't know very many people who don't feel compassion when there is a terrible school shooting. But then the conversation shifts from that and you automatically assume the worst of the other. That is one of the fundamental flaws in our political system today.
You're assuming the worst in someone
else.
You're
just assuming the worst in someone else. You refuse to see, and our politicians feed into this, to see that there are holistic approaches to so many of these issues, and it's not always going to be a binary decision. We don't allow for that.
Can I give you one more example that really drives this home for me and bothers me? And I fall for it as much as anyone. And so this is more just a warning to myself, a reminder to myself, and hopefully maybe to some listeners as well. It's also the case that you're very unwilling to hear that argument if it's coming from the other side. Mm-hmm. And so there was an interesting piece in the New York Times recently about schools that had gotten rid of the SAT or standardized testing for higher education. And when that had first happened, people on the right were constantly saying, do not get rid of this. Merit is one of the ways that immigrant communities, for instance, can rise up and stand out in an otherwise mediocre public school, for example. And that was, of course, like, oh, you're racist. And, you know, the tests are clearly racist, et cetera. Well, this long piece in the New York Times comes out now about 10 years after this experiment has started showing, oh, exactly that. But it was coming from people on the left saying, you know, actually, you know, just because the test has racial disparity doesn't mean you get rid of the test. It means you take that into account through other ways. But if a kid goes to a crappy public school and rocks it on the SAT, great, versus relying on teacher recommendations or extracurriculars, all things that actually, it turns out, the wealthy and the well-connected have been able to gain far more than the lower income or minority populations.
There's so much nuance and so much at work in right. the question of what to...
But now that it's coming from the left, those on the left are like, well, that's a really good point, and we need to reconsider this. But there was a line in this New York Times piece that I'll paraphrase, but it's something like, there's racial disparity in housing, but we don't get rid of houses. And, you know, and we don't get rid of mortgages, for instance, so that nobody can buy a house anymore. And boy, we should take arguments from the other side and try to hear them with that compassion in mind instead of waiting for our own side to make the argument and being like, oh, yeah, there's, that's a really good point.
Good place to land. We're going to leave it there. And it's time to turn to our left, right, and center rants and raves. Sarah, you're up. You're laughing.
I'm laughing. I always like to give raves on this show. Why rant? You know,
yeah.
Like there's so much
rave.
To rant
so
about
to
in the world.
To celebrate in the world.
Yes. And so like instead we should focus on the really fabulous, wonderful things that make us joyful to be alive.
I love this.
And for this week, mine is the discovery of antibiotics. I mean, can you just imagine what it was like to live 100 years ago where if you got a cut on your foot, that might be it. We had a president lose a son because he got a blister playing tennis on the White House courts, died from it. And because of antibiotics now, we're just good to go. We can cut ourselves. We can get strep. We can get UTIs.
Not advisable, but... But you're going to live.
Lick that doorknob, man. You're going to be okay. And it's these wonderful, you know, scientists and it's luck and it's timing and it's all of these things that brought us to this place to be alive in 2024 with antibiotics. And you know what? All of you listening and being like, what about the overuse of antibiotics? What about antibiotics? No, that's your rant for another time. I am currently raving about being alive in the age of antibiotics.
Was there an anniversary or something I missed, or did you just woke up deciding?
No, absolutely not.
Like, okay, you just wanted to.
You just took some antibiotics
and wanted to talk about.
As a parent, I mean, what would life be like if you couldn't give your child antibiotics? My son had this weird cut on his head, and it started getting real weird, real funky. And like, there's antibiotic cream.
Mo?
Well, I do like to rant.
We know.
Just because I'm a curmudgeon. It is campaign season, and if you live in a competitive or in an early primary state or a battleground state in a general election, you will know what I'm talking about. It means we're in robocall season. You know, those automated calls that bug you at dinner where you hear a candidate's recorded voice. They are starting and they are in full force. If you were in New Hampshire in the last week, you probably, and you were a registered Democrat, you may have heard this.
We know the value of voting Democratic when our votes count. It's important that you save your vote for the November election. We'll need your help in electing Democrats up and down the ticket. Voting this Tuesday only enables the Republicans in their quest to elect Donald Trump again. Your vote makes a difference in November, not this Tuesday.
Doesn't sound that out of the ordinary, right? Joe Biden's voice making a political pitch. But if you actually listen to it, it's Joe Biden saying, don't vote. That doesn't sound ordinary. Why? Because that wasn't Joe Biden. The New Hampshire Attorney General is now investigating what is apparently a deep fake AI-generated robocall made to sound like Joe Biden.
That's bad.
We talk about misinformation, disinformation on this show a lot. It is a problem. It is about to get a lot worse. We don't know how to deal with it yet. And so I don't have a plea to people out here other than be very, very careful in how you take in information moving forward.
Scary that this could be just the beginning. All right, I want to kind of rant and rave about some football fans. Buffalo Bills kicker Tyler Bass was excruciating, missed a field goal wide right in a playoff game against Kansas City. He then got hate mail. He got threats on social media, which is as awful as it is unsurprising. But then some fans wanted to find a way to do the right thing. Tyler Bass in the past had helped rescue cats, and a cat adoption organization that works with him in New York State, the 10 Lives Club, has gotten more than $150,000 in donations in Bass's name since that game. So I'm here to rave about that.
Meow!
And wide right means a lot of things to Buffalo Bills fans. If you know, you know. That is all the time we have for today. Sarah and Mo, thank you. It is great to be with you in person. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Phil Richards. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Special shout out to Clean Cut Studio here in Washington, D.C. for hosting us for this episode. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media, and we are distributed by PRX. I'm David Green. It's campaign season. More reason to come back and join us for more Left, Right, and Center next week.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
From PRX.